عن حال الوالدة.
Your mother is a mother of two martyrs, and that is not an easy thing. She is also a mother of an injured son who is fighting on the battlefield. How is she now? How is her morale after being displaced from her home and losing two of her sons?
يعني ولداها شهيدان.
She is a mother, and for sure she is sad.
There is pain and sadness.
But on the other side, she's so happy because her sons joined this path. That's an honorable thing. She thanks God that they died on this path and not because of any other reason.
Some opponents of the resistance in Lebanon believe that the resistance society is now in a state of weakness and brokenness, as they have either been displaced from their homes, lost their relatives, or seen their homes, villages, and towns destroyed. What do you want to tell those who think so?
It's not a broken society at all. As I told you, whenever a person is killed, we become stronger. Despite being displaced from our homes, we will continue to support the resistance at any price. We always remember the Battle of Karbala and how they continued fighting despite their circumstances. Sayyida Zainab Salamullah lost all her family, but she continued on the path. We will also continue the path. Karbala is a role model for us.
To what extent does Karbala give you the strength to accept all these sacrifices?
Until the last breath, we always say what's happening to us is nothing compared to the Battle of Karbala. Remembering the Battle of Karbala makes us stronger and increases our determination to continue.
This war began 13 months ago along the southern borders, where the border villages were being repeatedly attacked by the Israeli forces. At the same time, the resistance fighters were striking the enemy. How did you feel during this period, especially since your village, Ait al-Jabal, is close to the borders? How did you feel during the past 13 months?
We did not leave our homes.
You remained in the south all that time.
Yes, we remained in the south all that time. I am never afraid. I even feel happy when an attack is conducted against the enemy. I was even told that I am so fanatical for the resistance. I feel happy and proud of our fighters. So we didn't leave our home. Even when we went to Beirut, we were not planning to relocate. We were just on a short trip.
Then when you went to Beirut along with your fiancé, it was just a visit.
Yes, a visit after which we should have returned. But because of the incidents, my father asked us not to return.
Because returning to the south was so dangerous.
Yes.
Aline, you were a child when the July 2006 war erupted. What are your memories from that war?
I don't remember many things. I just remember when we were at home and a nearby explosion took place.
Were you in the south during the war?
Yes, yes.
Didn't you leave the south back then?
No, we went to Beirut in the middle of the war, but the war was not like the current one. It was weaker.
You believe that the current war is stronger?
Yes, it's stronger because there are more capabilities and more progress.
Many Israeli researchers conduct numerous studies on the resistance society. Why does this society cling to the path of resistance? Why doesn't this society suffer when a major loss is inflicted upon it? Why does this society continue to support the resistance despite the widespread destruction?
Because we know that God is watching and that efforts exerted on the path of resistance are not in vain. We also know this is the right path. We are clinging to this path because we know that it will lead us to the right destination. Additionally, because we know that the world is fleeting.
Do you think that the enemy can find a way to disconnect the resistance movement from the resistance society?
لفك هذا الارتباط ما بين بيئة المقاومة وما بين المقاومة؟
No way, that's impossible. This is something that has been implanted in us since our early childhood. They can't remove it from us, no matter what they do.
They can't do so.
No, they can't do so.
Aileen, what do you want to tell the Arab audience who are following the situation in Lebanon and wondering how the Lebanese people are, especially those in the south and the families of the martyrs? How do you want to describe your morale to those who think you are broken or defeated?
During the Battle of Karbala, Sayyida Zainab Salamullah said, "I saw nothing but beauty." We also saw nothing but beauty. Thank God for everything.
The resistance is lucky to have such a society. All the cities around the world can understand this real faith and the real secret behind this relation, except those who knew the Battle of Karbala and the path of resistance. How do you see the future? When you witness the widespread destruction in the southern suburbs, your home turned into rubble, the city of Tyre and the city center of Nabatea completely destroyed, and Israeli strikes putting the monuments of Baal back at risk.
We will reconstruct everything and make it better than before, as Nasrallah told us.
Do you have any doubt about that?
No.
Some people may ask, where does this great confidence come from?
It comes from our reliance on Allah the Almighty and the speeches of Nasrallah, who told us we will rebuild our homes and make them better than before. Nasrallah has never said anything that didn't come true.
After the resistance movement has lost many of its senior figures, particularly its martyred Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, do you think that the resistance has become weak or lost part of its strength and subsequently is no longer able to confront the occupier?
No, I don't think so. The resistance movement doesn't end when it loses its leader or senior figures. Nasrallah even said that when a leader is martyred, others will replace him.
Such a faith has many lessons that deserve to be learned. At the end of this interview, what do you want to tell this society, which is suffering in one way or another, but is still persistent, to boost its morale?
Despite losing young people and our homes, we will continue on this path and will support the resistance till our last breath. Our martyrs don't die, they are alive in our hearts, and we will keep remembering them. We will definitely triumph and return to the south and build better homes. God willing, victory is ours.
Thank you so much, Aileen Hossein Murtada, for this interview. We really hope that this society will be victorious. We hope to return to our villages in the south and reconstruct them together. We will build anything that was destroyed by the Zionist enemy thanks to this strong will that can actually beat any weapon or technology in the possession of the enemy. Thank you so much, Aileen Hossein Murtada, for this interview. Goodbye.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
This title given to the 11th Imam, Al-Askari, is because of a military camp.
Al-Kindi, he was a philosopher who lived during the time of Imam Hassan Al-Askari.
دیدم امام 11 سلام الله علیه به سمت موکبی حرکت می‌کند.
When he gets there, he finds Imam moving towards a community who are anticipating him.
This is Dialogue, an introduction on the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam Hassan al-Askari, alayhi salam. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mehdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Hassan al-Askari alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Hassan ibn Ali al-Askari alayhi salam, the father of the 12th divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Mahdi, was the 11th Imam of the infallible Imams from the Ahlul Bayt of the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. The blessed and pious Imam carried the banner of Islam, undertook the goals of the religion, and sacrificed his life unto this way. He was indeed a fountainhead of knowledge and wisdom. He faced many incredible difficulties and tragedies and hardships in order to spread and promote and keep intact the high values and goals of the religion of Islam. Truly, there are so many countless favors that have been bestowed upon the Muslims by the divinely appointed Imams, the infallible and immaculate Imams, including Imam Hassan al-Askari alayhi salam. Welcome back. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Askari alayhi salam. Of course, Imam Hassan ibn Ali al-Askari alayhi salam is the father of the 12th divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Mahdi. May Allah hasten his reappearance, especially in these days where we are, you know, facing pretty difficult times as a Muslim ummah. So may Allah please, you know, we beg the Almighty Allah to hasten the reappearance in order to save us from these calamities that we are facing on the level of the Muslim ummah. So there's this individual who has this correspondence with Imam Hassan ibn Ali al-Askari alayhi salam. So, of course, some of the conversations that His Eminence had were not just one-on-one, face-to-face conversations. Many of the conversations that occur between the companions and the followers of Imam Hassan al-Askari alayhi salam, they happen via correspondence, via letters. Because, of course, at that time, letters is what was the primary way of corresponding with people in different parts of the Muslim world. And so an individual by the name of Shahway ibn Abdurrabi, he says that his brother Saleh was in prison. And so he wrote to Imam Hassan al-Askari alayhi salam and asked him about some things. Now, between the Imam and his followers, of course, we find that the correspondence and the letters and the questions, you know, usually had to do with socio-political questions, religious jurisprudential questions, economic financial questions. And so he asked a few of these things to Imam Hassan al-Askari alayhi salam. And so when he received the reply from the divinely appointed Imam, Imam Askari alayhi salam had written that your brother Saleh shall be set free from prison on the day when this letter of mine shall reach you. And then Imam Askari alayhi salam also writes, you wanted to ask me about him, but you had forgotten. And so Shahway ibn Abdurrabi, he says that while I was reading this letter, someone came to my house and told me that my brother had just been set free. And so I received my brother and we read this letter again together. I mean, again, showing us that how concerned the divinely appointed imams in their respective era are for their followers, and they are for the people who love them and the people who want to be connected to them and the people who respect them. You know, this is how these divinely appointed imams treat their followers, respect their followers, love their followers. Only if we, their followers, were to love them in return. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Askari, alayhi salam. IRIB English Radio. Please follow our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir. And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
An Imam said that knowing the decree of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, I didn't want to go against it, and that's why I didn't pray for your other son. And this is where Anush says, La uridu ya sayyidi illa ma turid. I submit myself to you. If that is what you are saying, I agree with the decree of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. You know, in the ziyarat waris, we always say to Imam Hussain alayhi salam, Silmi qalbi li qalbikum silm. Then my heart submits to your heart. It is in these moments that the imtihan comes in. Not only, you know, what we want to do, or, you know, haram and halal. When we are put into test and trial, that's where we have to see whether we submit to the decree of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala or not. The narrator of this event, Abu Ja'far Ahmad al-Qasir al-Basri, he says that indeed after 3 days one of his sons died, the other survived. After a few years we had seen him, he became a Muslim, he was a Shia, and he was with us during the wafat of Imam Hassan al-Askari alayhi salatu wassalam. And so yes, it was a very precarious situation, you know, communication with the Imam was not that easy. But we still see that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will bring about situations that the greatness of the Imam would still be reflected even publicly. And although his imamat was only for 6 years.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program, Dialogue. For more information, visit our website at iranradio.ir. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
in the limelight.
Senior Russian lawmakers warned on Sunday, 17th of November, that Washington's decision to let Kiev strike deep into Russia with long-range U.S. missiles escalates the conflict in Ukraine and could lead to a new world war. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. The Reuters news agency has covered this story and tells us more. Washington's decision to let Kiev strike deep into Russia with long-range U.S. missiles escalates the conflict in Ukraine and could lead to World War III, according to senior Russian lawmakers speaking on Sunday. Two U.S. officials and a source familiar with the decision revealed the significant reversal of Washington's policy in the Ukraine-Russia conflict earlier on Sunday, 17th of November. Andrei Klishas, a senior member of the Federation Council, Russia's upper chamber of parliament, said, "The West has decided on such a level of escalation that it could end with the Ukrainian statehood in complete ruins by morning." Vladimir Zhabarov, the first deputy head of the Russian upper house of parliament's International Affairs Committee, said, "Moscow's response will be immediate. This is a very big step towards the start of the Third World War," the TASS news agency quoted Zhabarov as saying. President Vladimir Putin said back in September that the West would be fighting Russia directly if it allowed Ukraine to strike Russian territory with Western-made long-range missiles, a move, he said, would alter the nature and the scope of the war. Russia would be forced to take what President Putin called appropriate decisions based on the new threats. Leonid Slutsky, the chairman of the State Duma, lower house of parliament's Foreign Affairs Committee, said U.S. authorization of strikes by Kiev on Russia with U.S. ATAC-MS tactical missiles would lead to the toughest response, the Russian news agencies quoted Slutsky as saying. The TASS news agency quoted Slutsky saying, "Strikes with U.S. missiles deep into Russian region will inevitably entail a serious escalation of the war, which threatens to lead to much more serious consequences." NATO member Poland welcomed President Biden's decision. The Polish Foreign Minister Radoslaw Sikorski posted on X, formerly known as Twitter, "Strength deters, weakness provokes." Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has long pushed for authorization from Washington to use the powerful Army tactical missile system, known by its initials ATAC-MS, to hit targets deep inside Russia. Russian President Vladimir Putin has warned that approval of such a move would mean that NATO was effectively at war with his country. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story. US President Joe Biden has lifted the ban on Ukraine using long-range missiles to fire into Russian territory by permitting them to be used against Russian and North Korean forces in the Kursk region of Russia. US President Joe Biden will allow Ukraine to use US-made ATAC-MS rockets, which have a range of 300 kilometers, a decision being justified by the presence of North Korean troops fighting alongside Russian troops. Though there was no public comment from the White House, the story first appeared in coordinated briefings to the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Reuters and Associated Press news agencies. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky appeared to confirm the news, though he said any proof about the change in policy would emerge on the battlefield, if and when the missiles are used. President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine said, "Today there's a lot of talk in the media about us receiving permission for respective actions. But strikes are not carried out with words. Such things are not announced. Missiles will speak for themselves. They certainly will." Poland's foreign minister welcomed the news. Radoslav Sikorski wrote on X, "With the entry into the war of North Korean troops and the massive airstrike of Russian missiles, President Biden has responded to this escalation." But Vladimir Zhabarov, the first deputy head of the Russian Upper House of Parliament's International Affairs Committee, warned Moscow's response would be immediate. Vladimir Zhabarov said, "This is a very big step towards the start of the Third World War." The TASS news agency quoted Zhabarov as saying, "It is the first time that President Biden has given Kiev permission to use long-range weapons inside Russia, but their use apparently will be limited to the Kursk region, where Ukraine launched an incursion into Russian territory last summer." Kiev announced nationwide energy rationing from Monday, 18th of November, after Moscow's biggest drone and missile attacks in months on Ukraine's energy infrastructure on Sunday, 17th of November. U.S. officials briefed that the weapons would be used against Russian and North Korean troops deployed against Ukrainian forces in the Kursk region. And the move was intended to send a message to North Korea, although Joe Biden may authorize their use elsewhere during his remaining 2 months in office. The first strikes using U.S.-supplied attack MS rockets could come within days. The decision is not thought to apply to British-supplied Storm Shadow missiles, the use of which on Russian territory has previously been blocked by the United States. Kiev has indicated it wants to use the British-made Storm Shadow missiles against air bases used to launch attacks on Ukraine instead of the Kursk region of Russia. It is not clear if the incoming U.S. President Donald Trump, who has previously criticized the scale of U.S. military aid to Ukraine, will seek to reverse the decision made by President Joe Biden. Biden previously allowed Ukraine to use shorter-range U.S.-supplied HIMARS missiles against Russian forces attacking Kharkiv from over the border, but had so far refused permission for deep strikes against Russia.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Conversation. Hello, I'm Sean Murray, and this is The Conversation, where we take an alternative look at political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. In this show, we hope to pick, probe, investigate, and uncover the stories that you want to hear. We go where mainstream won't go. This week, we will be speaking to an acclaimed academic and author who has been at the forefront of numerous high-profile human rights fights for justice. Now an adopted son of Belfast, he's never found wanting when his wisdom or expertise is called for local or grassroots communities. But before we do, let's get a quick overview on this week's topic.
On the 15th of April 1989, a severe crush in two central pens at Hillsborough Stadium, Sheffield, led to the deaths of 97 Liverpool fans. It occurred as the FA Cup semi-final between Liverpool and Nottingham Forest kicked off. Shortly before kick-off, the inexperienced match commander, Chief Superintendent David Duckinfield, with a clear view above the terrace from the police control box, ordered exit gate C to be opened to ease crowding at malfunctioning turnstiles. Fans, unstewarded, entered through gate C and down an unlawful 1-in-6 gradient tunnel headed standing. Yet the pens were already severely overcrowded. Fans were trapped by high fences to the sides and to the front. So severe was the crush, a barrier collapsed and bodies piled up. In addition to the eventual 97 deaths, 766 fans were injured and thousands traumatised. The deadliest tragedy in British sporting history. In the immediate aftermath, South Yorkshire senior police officers and the Police Federation fed false stories to the media, claiming violent Liverpool fans, many without tickets and drunk, had caused the disaster. These allegations persisted throughout a hostile media, despite Lord Justice Taylor's 1990 interim report finding the main cause was the police failure to control the crowd. Yet, there were no prosecutions of police officers or public bodies, and initial inquests returned an accidental death verdict. This led to a 3-decades-long campaign by bereaved families and survivors. Addressing the 20th anniversary memorial at Anfield in front of a crowd of 30,000, the Culture Secretary, Andy Burnham, committed the Labour government to full documentary disclosure by all organisations involved. In 2010, the Hillsborough Independent Panel was appointed by the UK government to oversee and analyse the disclosed documents and publish a detailed report. On the 12th September 2012, it published its report. It launched a website containing extensive material collated from 85 organisations and individuals over 2 years. The panel concluded that the behaviour of fans in no way contributed to the disaster. The main cause was lack of police control. Crowd safety had been compromised at every level, despite previous near-death incidents on the terrace. The panel concluded that up to 41 of those who died might have survived had the response of the police and emergency services been appropriate. Before a packed House of Commons, Prime Minister David Cameron apologised on behalf of the government, Ed Miliband on behalf of the opposition. Other authorities, including the South Yorkshire Police, followed suit. Former editor of The Sun, Kelvin McKenzie, initially apologised for making false accusations under the headline The Truth. Subsequently, this was moderated. New inquests were initiated lasting 2 years. The jury concluded all who died had been unlawfully killed, and the fans were exonerated of any blame.
And with that, I would like to introduce my guest. Professor Phil Scraton has been a leading light for those challenging corrupt institutional power structures. Widely known for his work on the Hillsborough Independent Panel, a team that was instituted to oversee the disclosure of documents about the disaster that led to the deaths of 97 Liverpool fans in 1989, he has been at the centre of many other successful institutional findings since. Phil, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sean.
So, Phil, tell me first of all a bit about yourself growing up.
Well, I was born on the other side of the river from Liverpool in Wallasey. My mother was from Birkenhead, a Birkenhead Catholic, an Irish background. My father was a Liverpool-born Protestant, and so I was the product of a mixed marriage, and so understood right from the outset the issues that the tensions that exist around religion, particularly the tensions between Irish Catholicism and English Protestantism. And my father converted, actually, but never went to church. And I grew up in not a very wealthy family, but somehow one of the only handful of people from my school. I got the 11 plus, went to a grammar school, which I hated from the moment I walked in. It was a former public school, and it had all those traditions. And the young ones got beaten by the old ones and all of that. It was a dreadful introduction to the world of immediate power, power relations on that level. And it worked at two levels. One, I felt that subjugation because I was a Catholic in a Protestant grammar school. But I also felt the subjugation of poverty. I came from a home where my mother and father had to scrimp just to get me to the school, to buy the uniform, for example, and all the gear that goes with that. So I felt lost. And within 2 years, I'd left. And believe it or believe it not, these days, I went into a seminary. I'd been an altar boy since I'd been very young in the local Catholic church. And yeah, the priest would come round every Friday night and they'd talk and chat. And they got me to play for the local church team and all of that. So my first love was football and Liverpool FC, which I know won't go down that well with you, Sean. But that was my first love. And second was, I suppose, I was devoted to the church. I mean, I was, 8, 9, 10, 11 when I was on the altar. So it seemed obvious to me that maybe going off and trying to emulate the priests that I had so admired at that time, that was why I went into the seminary. There was also, at that time, another formative moment which never left me and which I should have realised even at that age was the real contradiction. There was a wee fella in my church, in my school, who was really poor. We weren't well off, but he was really poor. And he used to steal from the local shop, but he didn't steal sweets. And he didn't steal lemonade, he stole food. And that food he would steal to take to his family. And this was the first time I ever experienced anything like this. Later in life, I went through this again. And he got caught. And I'll never forget the day all the girls were taken out of assembly and all the women teachers left the assembly. And we sat cross-legged on the floor. And we didn't know what was happening. So there was a bang at the back of the hall, and we were sat there rigid, and these two teachers walked up. They looked massive from where we were. And wee Frank was walking between them, and they got him up to the stage, and the head teacher was on the stage, the deputy head, and the local parish priest. And the head teacher looked at all of us and said, "This week, Frank Ruddy was found stealing. And he is on the stage because of that. He let himself down. He let the school down. He let his family down. But most of all, he let God down." And they took him. They bent him over a desk. And they caned him 6 times across his backside. And they marched him down from the stage. And as he walked past, the tears were streaming down his face. Otherwise, he was emotionless. I sat there terrified. In fact, I was holding on to myself. I thought I was going to wet myself. And I learned a lesson that day, that moment, which didn't really click for a while afterwards. It was about the use and abuse of power, physical abuse of power. And that stayed with me. Even after that, when I went to the seminary, that stayed with me. And I saw that sort of behavior again in the seminary. And I lived for 4 years in under that fear, in that kind of situation, and also in the seminary, I was very well aware that some of my friends were being abused. And I left the seminary in 1966. In fact, I will never forget the moment I left the seminary. It was like a massive pressure lifted from me. It also coincided with the World Cup, and I went to Goodison Park three times to see the Brazil match, the Portugal match, and the North Korea match. And that was my first and last experience of Everton's football ground, because I was never missed across the park at Anfield.
Well, we both have many discussions on the rivalry between Everton and Liverpool, but we'll save that for another day.
Yeah.
So tell me, Phil, how did you come to work and live in Belfast? Because you're now an adopted son.
After I got into academic work, and that was a strange experience in itself, because when I was finishing university, my first degree, which was sociology at Liverpool University, the thing that was said to me straight away was, what do you want to do? And I said, oh, I'd like to be a researcher. And basically, the career guidance guy who was in the School of Sociology smiled and laughed and said, no, I don't think you'd be cut out for research. I think you should go and be a social worker or a teacher or whatever. And nothing against social work or teaching, but I really wanted to do research. And so I enrolled for a master's by research, and I did it on the Irish-born Liverpool travelling community. And I witnessed there some of the worst racism I have ever seen. I come from a city where racism, particularly institutionalised by the police, on the Liverpool-born black community is really serious. But this was of a different order, seeing people dragged from their trailers in the middle of the night, their families. And I suddenly thought, am I a researcher or am I a witness to what is state abuse? So I wrote all that up, and that kind of steered me then into work in academic life, where the research was always going to be geared to abuse of power. And that work went on all the way through from that period, all the way through my work on institutionalized racism on Merseyside, my work on deaths in custody, my work on a whole range of controversial topics, which included eventually disasters and tragedies. And it was against that background that my, for want of a better word, career developed. I worked at the Open University full time. Then I worked at Edge Hill University, Liverpool University, and then I came to Belfast. I remember after the interview, I was travelling back to Aldergrove, and I was in the taxi, and the guy said, what have you been here for? And I said, I've been over for an interview. And he said, what on earth do you want to come to this place for? That was his response to, you live in Liverpool, why do you want to come here? And I thought to myself, this is a crazy question, because in my head, and I'd been coming here, I'd been a failure a lot, I'd done a lot of different things here, different talks, and I knew quite a few people in Belfast. And to me, I saw it as a privilege that I'd been offered a job in Belfast, because when else in your life would you have the opportunity to live and work in a place that is going through transition from conflict? This is on my doorstep. People in England had not even the slightest notion of what was really happening in the north. And from my point of view, to come here and to work in this environment during a period of transition, and this was a period when, as you will remember only too well, 20 years ago, when there was a lot of tension, particularly in the paramilitaries, amongst the loyalist paramilitaries, there was a lot of tension. And it was getting a lot of headlines in England. But to me, it wasn't about that. To me, it was about being part of the society which was really going to face major transitions. Because I think when people talk about the transition from war to peace, what they fail to think about is, at a distance, it looks like the war is over, peace prevails, everything changes. Well, it doesn't. We all know that is a complete myth. Anybody who's lived here knows that that is a complete myth. Because in that situation, intergenerational trauma becomes such a powerful force. People who've been in prison for long periods of time, people, hardly a family that hasn't, in working class communities, hardly a family that hasn't lost somebody or hasn't witnessed some of the worst examples of power being directed against them individually, whether by paramilitaries on the one hand, but most significantly by the state, the armed forces. I never forgot the moment when somebody said to me, one of the very first times I came here, when I went to school, she said, every day I came out of my house, I had to step over a rifle. Because we lived in a corner house. And the squaddie would be down with his rifle across the front of the step, and I had to step over that. That image stayed in my mind of a child. You know, I mean, yes, we all know the major atrocities. We all know the major conflict. We all know the situation of shootings, of bombings, and all the rest of it. We know that. But that one image of a young child stepping over that barrel every day and it being normalized as part of her life really stayed with me. So arriving in Belfast and witnessing and listening to people's stories, there was some of that was part of my own history, but not to the depth, not to the real pain of everyday life that had become normalized. And that to me was so significant. And the realization, working as I did with families, by that time families of the bereaved, families of prisoners, in a broader sense, that to me really had an impact, because what it was saying to me was, you know, this is an issue that's not going to go away in the medium period. So when people talk about transition from conflict, they have to understand that transition takes three generations minimum. I see that with my daughter-in-law, who is who was born in the former East in Berlin. I see it from her family's experiences, that you don't unlive the lived lives of your grandparents, of your parents, simply because you're born at a moment of peace. And you inherit that background, you inherit that suffering. The things that are said and left unsaid in families are all part of that history. So for me, it's I work around the issue of about three generations when we can start to put real meaningfulness on, yes, the society has transitioned. And it's not just about who's in power and what their histories are. That's part of it. But it's actually about personal experience.
I completely agree, Phil. And there's something that struck me. Me and you had a conversation one time about Manson. I know we have all these cliches and all these buzzwords around the peace process, etc. But I'd said to you, we've been talking about something that Manson, you know, a post-conflict society. And you stopped me and you says, it's not, we're not in a post-conflict society, we're still in conflict. And, yeah. And like it made me think, and you're absolutely right, to think that we're able to talk about a post-conflict society when there's so much trauma in our society still, when the injustices are still there, when the state is redacting documents, when they're burying the truth, when they're changing laws so families can't get to the truth, killing civil cases, inquests. We're not even in the end of the period where there is a post-conflict society. I think the British government is fighting a war on a new front against victims and survivors. So it did strike me when you said that, you know.
The inequality of arms that exists during a period of conflict, let's be clear about this. The inequality of arms is about a state intervening in a conflicted society. The state is not neutral. The state is never neutral. The state always supports a status quo which it considers is in its own best interests. And I'm talking here about not just about individual politicians, because there have been some good individual politicians, but I'm talking about the British state as an entity. And it has to protect its history. It has to protect its own direct involvement, not only in the deployment of the military in the north, but also its own. It has to protect its reputation in terms of being seen to be value neutral, which it never was. It's not only in the north, which is the north of Ireland, which is in itself a major, major issue. In terms of state involvement. But you see it at every level in the work I do, where the state interests, whether they're the police, the prisons, whatever, the state interests are always protected. So getting to the truth in the north is something that is not in the state's interest. To have the whole truth and nothing but the truth will never happen. I'm convinced it will never happen. In the work I do, not just on the North, but in the work I do, I see redacted documents. I see what it means for those in authority to go through documents and strike out passages. I've seen what it's like. I'm talking here, for example, around Hillsborough. I mean, these are 97 people who die at a football match, right? This is not about a civil war. This is about people dying at a football match. And I've seen how a panel of carefully selected police officers, under the direction of the chief constable, go through the statements of all of their police officers and review them and alter them. Now, review and alteration are not my words, they're their words. That's what they set up. So if you project that from 97 people dying at a football match into a situation where you have a war, where you have a relationship between the military and the police, why would we be surprised to discover that documents go missing, documents don't exist that should have existed, that when those documents are found, that they are redacted, that they are changed? Why would we be surprised if it can happen in the event of protecting reputations around policing football in a peaceful society, a harmonious society? Why would we be surprised that during a time when the state itself is conducting a war, when there is military on the streets, when the helicopters are flying in hour after hour, why would we be surprised to find that the truth is redacted in statements, or it's never written, or it's hidden? Doesn't surprise me in the slightest.
Phil, I want to thank you again for coming over to this side of the city to see me. You're always welcome, and it's always great to have you here in the West. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Sean. Thank you.
And that does it for another week. We'd love for you to join the conversation by sharing the link to today's programme to help us grow our audience across all our social media platforms. I'd once again like to thank our special guest, Phil Scraton. In the meantime, the conversation will be back next week with more investigations and analysis. I'm Sean Murray. Bye for now.
In the limelight.
Euromedium and Rights Monitor states that Israel's army has completely cut off the northern Gaza governorate from Gaza City by deploying military vehicles, placing sand barriers and the rubble of destroyed homes, in addition to fire cover from drones. Concerning this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, in Gaza, the Zionist regime forces are continuing to massacre, bomb, and starve the hundreds of thousands of Palestinians in the north while carrying out horrific slaughters in the central areas. In the northern Gaza Strip, the Zionist regime has been leveling neighborhoods in Jabalia and continuing to surround and attack homes, shelters, and hospitals. According to reporters and human rights organizations, the Israeli regime army has been sending automated vehicles and robots laden with explosives to destroy entire buildings. Euromed Human Rights Monitor states that Israel's army has completely cut off the northern Gaza governorate from Gaza City by deploying military vehicles, placing sand barriers and the rubble of destroyed homes, in addition to fire cover from drones. Using three different methods, aerial bombardment, booby-trapped robots, and planting explosives in homes before blowing them up, the Zionist regime army has increased its operations to destroy homes and residential buildings in the areas of its incursion in northern Gaza. Mohannad Hadi, the United Nations humanitarian coordinator for the occupied Palestinian territories, stated that since October 1st, Israeli authorities have increasingly cut off northern Gaza from essential supplies. Erez and Erez West crossings have been kept closed, and no essentials have been allowed from the south. Three renewed orders have been issued on 12th, 9th and 7th of October, directing people's displacement. According to Israeli media, the Israeli army is implementing a plan to ethnically cleanse northern Gaza and turn it into a closed military zone. The plan, conceived by retired Major General Gura Eland and carried out by Zionist regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, aims to push northern Gaza's residents south of Netzarim Corridor, threatening starvation and execution for those who remain. Euromed monitors stated recently that nearly 400,000 Palestinians in the northern Gaza Strip are at risk of starvation, including approximately 200,000 who have been without food or water for nearly 2 weeks. The rights group reported, after their limited food supplies ran out, dozens of Palestinians trapped in the Jabalia refugee camp were forced to head to the main food supply center of the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees in order to secure food for their families. However, the Israeli media targeted them with shells and quadcopter drones, killing 10 people and injuring at least 40 more. Many of the victims are still lying in the streets and cannot be taken to the hospital due to the threat of further Israeli violence. The Zionist regime said that it allowed the entry of 30 flour trucks into the North Gaza Governorate through Erez Crossing, but the Gaza government media office admonished this token flour delivery as a public relations move, as the Zionist regime systematically starves Gaza and tightens the siege. What is happening in the northern Gaza Strip is actual genocide and ethnic cleansing, the media office said recently, adding, and the total destruction of homes, residential neighborhoods, streets, roads, infrastructure, hospitals, schools, mosques, and all vital sectors, which comes within the framework of the American-Israeli occupation for displacement, which is the largest and most dangerous American-Israeli occupation plan in the 21st century. Meanwhile, the UN's health cluster says that all three hospitals in North Gaza, Kamal Adwan, Al Audeh, and the Indonesian hospital, are operating at minimum capacity amid dire shortages of fuel, blood units, trauma disposables, medications for patients with non-communicable diseases, and the ongoing military activities nearby. The Palestinian Ministry of Health in Gaza stated over the weekend that dead and injured people remained in the streets and under the rubble where ambulance crews could not reach them. The ministry added that the Israeli regime army has prevented the entry of blood units from the southern Gaza Strip to hospitals in the north. In Gaza City, journalist Mu'tasem Dalul reported on a massacre in the Zaytun neighborhood. In central Gaza, the Zionist regime carried out several massacres on school shelters and tents of displaced people. Recently, the Zionist regime army bombed the Mufti school in Nuseirat refugee camp, killing at least 22 and injuring 80. Another strike on Nuseirat recently killed at least 5 Palestinians. The Zionist regime bombed the tents of displaced Palestinians inside the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital courtyard, killing at least 4 and injuring dozens. In images and photos that were circulated worldwide, flames engulfed the tent shelters, burning people alive. Sha'ban al-Dalu, 19, was killed alongside his mother. He had survived an Israeli regime airstrike earlier this month and was recovering from his injuries. He was still hooked up to an intravenous drip. Contributor Abu Akbar Abed reported that Al-Dalu was a freshman at the Al-Azhar University of Gaza studying software engineering. Abed said, "Israel destroyed his home and his university and immolated him yesterday at Al-Aqsa Martyr